Good evening. I mean that sincerely, just in case you have any wonders about honesty, which is our topic for tonight. There is a very well-known pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim we read this week. Of course, there are many well-known psukim. It's a parsha that is chock full of directives on the interpersonal realm, and one that perhaps stands out among them is the notion of Midvar Sheker Tirchak. And I'd like to try to discuss a little bit tonight just some of the complexity in terms of understanding what may seem like a very straightforward principle and commandment, and how exactly it's interpreted and what the implications are. Sometimes the assumption is that it translates the way the song goes, the song, at least from my childhood, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, never tell a lie. So is that actually the accurate rendition of what that pasuk is telling to us? So does it actually refer to lies in such an absolute way that we are never allowed to tell any? Is that the message? So here we find some definite room to wonder and to debate. And the exact range and scope of this concept, if it even is an Isser to begin with, is the topic of a lot of discussion. And a part of it is that the language is unusual. So when the Torah wants to prohibit something, the Gemara says in a few places that there are four languages of Isser that we have. Hishamer, Lav, Lo, Pen, Al. These are words the Torah uses when it wants to say that something is Aser. Tirchak is unusual, perhaps unique. So how are we supposed to understand if the Torah tells us Midvar Sheker Tirchak? So first of all, whether there's any Isser at all here is subject to question. And if there is an Isser, what exactly is the range of the Isser? What exactly is the applicability of it? That's also a question. So as far as this unusual language, we'll mention over the course of our discussion here probably a few interpretations of what the message of Tirchak is. But just to scope out the extremes. So on the one hand, there are those who see this as not only a prohibition, but kind of a mega prohibition, and saying in the extreme that when the Torah wants to prohibit something, yes, indeed, it suffices with language of don't. But here it says don't even come close. And that is an extreme way of prohibiting it. And that was the understanding, for example, of the Sefer Achinuch, who expressed Reirov Tiuvo, because of the great revulsion that we have for Sheker. The Torah doesn't suffice in just saying don't, but says don't even come close. At the other extreme, there are those who assumed that this isn't the language of prohibition, and that indeed we have other words for. And here the Torah is not saying don't, but is saying avoid. It's saying it's something to stay away from, but is not prohibited in the same absolute sense. Now, this is a tricky topic overall, because we certainly know that the idea of emes is one of our core values. And the Gemara tells us in Shabbos that chesamto yishol HaKadosh Baruch Hu emesu, that God's seal is truth. And any implication that we take that less than completely seriously would be a mistake, because I want to dispel that impression at the very beginning. We certainly are devoted to MS as an absolute ideal. And the pasuk in Tehillim says, Divers Shkarim, Lo Yikon Keneged Einai, that God says, I can't bear, abide by somebody who speaks lies. There's no question that as a value, MS is very much front and center. But as a strict prohibition in terms of any false statement, is that actually the case? So here's where we find some room to wonder. And even if we do assume that Midvar Sheker Tirchak does constitute a prohibition, it's a question of what exactly that prohibition applies to. And among the theories, we could perhaps compare it to American law, that in American law, if you were to say something simply that it's just factually not true, just the fact that what you're saying isn't actually the truth, that doesn't automatically constitute a crime. That's not going to get you thrown in jail. That may be a minimal requirement to run for office, but it's not something that is itself a punishable crime. When does lying become actually illegal, an actual crime? So we could mention two categories of falsehoods that are punishable felonies. One is lying under oath in a formal context, so we call perjury. And the other would be if it's a lie that victimizes someone else, say in a monetary sense, so then that would be called fraud. So in those two areas, you have punishable crimes connected to falsehood. And there are theories that that might be the extent also when it comes to Midvar Sheker Tirchak. So first of all, to focus on perjury for a moment, the Gemara Masechet Shavuos on Daf Lamed has a number of interpretations of Midvar Sheker Tirchak, a whole list of about 11, 12 rules that emerge from this idea of Midvar Sheker Tirchak, and those are all in a Beis Din context. Those are all in a formal courtroom environment. So that would support the theory that Rabbi Yochum Fishel Perlau in his commentary to Rav Sadia Gaon's Sefer HaMitzvos and the Sefer Aruch Meisharim takes the same perspective as well, that that's primarily what we're talking about. It's only in that context. Now, we should note that if we're going to build this based on that passage in the Gemara in Shavuos, so there are other Gemaras that sound differently. Perhaps most well-known is the debate between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, or at least half of it is well-known, because if you go to a Jewish wedding, so we know the big song, Ketza Meraktim Lifnei HaKala, Kala Nova Chesuda, how do you dance in front of the Kala? You say that she is a beautiful bride. So that's what the song tells us. And if you see the Gemara inside, in Ksubas and Daf Yud Zayin, so you'll see that that's the view of Beis Hillel. But the band doesn't sing, is that Beis Shammai disagrees. And Beis Shammai's view is, maybe you're not so impressed. How could you say something that you don't actually believe? Does the Torah not say, Midvar Sheker Tirchok? So that statement seems to suggest that here the prohibition applies in a context that's very different from perjury, that's very far from a formal courtroom proceeding kind of environment. So what does that tell us as far as the scope? So there are some who point to that Gemara as a contradictory source, but it's also the case that we don't follow the view of Beis Shammai. We follow the view of Beis Hillel. Why that is, in terms of where is their actual point of difference, so that is a discussion, but it's certainly possible to say that Beis Shammai's invoking of this pasuk is itself a part of what is not accepted, lahalacha. So how exactly to process that quote is somewhat of an open question, but just to acknowledge that you have Gemaras like that, which do also quote Midvar Sheker Tirchak in a much more day-to-day kind of environment and application. So that's one possibility, that it's basically interpreted in a fraud, in a perjury kind of connotation. Moving to the fraud example, so in civil law, if I lie in a way that victimizes someone, so that would be considered a crime. So there are those who understand Midvar Sheker Tirchak in such a context as well. And notable here is the Sefer Yireim, who sees Midvar Sheker Tirchak as a Ben Adam Machavero. It's essentially an interpersonal principle. It's not a outright ban on any statement that's not factually correct, but rather it is a rule in terms of treating others that we shouldn't hurt other people by deceiving them. So that basically is a fraud kind of model. And that's another way of understanding it. Now, within the Sefer Yireim, so it is a question how he would relate then to all other types of falsehoods that don't necessarily involve deceiving people harmfully. So there are those, there's a commentary on the Sefer Yireim that understands that there is a Isser Drabanan, at least, involved in basic falsehood. That's the commentary of the Tosfos Reim, Tosfos Reim, to the Sefer Yireim. And there are those who go further, and there are those who suggest in the Sefer Nivsu Asayim, which is the whole Sefer about Sheker. So he really understands that the Sefer Yireim actually sees all prohibitions as covered by something, so that the actual Sheker in the point of focus here, that is the harmful deception. But the language of Terechak, so that means to include those situations that don't fall in that category but could lead you to that category. So it could be in that interpretation that the Sefer Yireim does understand this primarily as being about deceiving people harmfully, but nonetheless, as a matter of practice, also including other falsehood as well. So we have a range of theories here. There are those who say that there is a Yisra Daraisa in any false statement, and there are those who say this pasuk isn't really an Yisra at all. The Smak assumes that there is a positive mitzvah, at least. He says, how could there not be a positive mitzvah to speak the truth? But even if we say that there is an Yisra here, so it's not clear if the Yisra covers basic dishonesty in a non-harmful, non-courtroom setting. The Chafetz Chaim, in his Sefer Shmiras HaLashon, when he talks about the prohibitions that are involved in Lashon Hara, and he has this whole list, so he also includes lying as a general prohibition, and he writes there that according to everybody it's an Yisra Deraisa. So what exactly is the Yisra is itself also open to discussion. But that's a part of the view here. So the idea that there wouldn't be an Isser on more mundane kinds of falsehood, or at least not an absolute prohibition, so some thought that you have to say that way, because how else do we accommodate the fact that we know that there are times when it's permitted and maybe even advocated that we stretch the truth, to phrase it conservatively, whether it's actual lying or stretching the truth. So we do find that sometimes Chazal allow or command us to do that. So one, I think we spoke about a few weeks ago, is the Gemara in Yevamos, which tells us that it is mutter l'shanos bedvar hashalom, that it's permissible to deviate from the truth. The language l'shanos may be softer than l'shaker, maybe that's relevant, but that's permissible for the sake of peace. And then the Gemara goes on to give another pin. It's not just mutter, it's a mitzvah, it's an obligation when the circumstances warrant it. And the Gemara in Bava Metzia, in the second parak, where the Gemara talks about the requirement that you demand proof when you're returning property, you have to protect the property and only give it back to the person who actually lost it, and you have to demand proof. They have to give you simanim, they have to give you signs of identification that the property is theirs. But the Gemara says that Talmud Chacham, who is known to be honest, that's the definition of a Talmud Chacham, he can get the property back with Tzvi Asayim. He can look at it and say, it's mine, and we'll believe him. And in that context, the Gemara says that there are a few categories, a few areas, where even that Talmud Chacham can stretch the truth, and he won't be considered dishonest to remove himself from this category. And the Gemara gives these three examples. One was Ushpizin, if somebody was hosted well by another, and he wants to conceal that or misrepresent that because he's worried if everyone knows what great hospitality this guy provides, he's going to get besieged with people inviting themselves. So to protect him, you don't want to be forthcoming about that. So that's acceptable. Another example is Masechta, which sounds like that's about modesty. That if somebody asks you, did you learn this, you can play down your learning in order to be more humble. To go in the other direction is a problem. That the Yerushalmi in Mako says that if you're going to play up your learning, pretend you learned more than you did, so that's a problem. But to go in the other direction, to play it down, so that's acceptable. And the third category is Puria, which probably translates as bed. It sounds like it's a reference to the relationship between husband and wife. It's not anybody's business. You're not obligated to be forthcoming about that if anybody asks you questions. There is a minority view, which we'll mention. It's somewhat seasonal, that the Marsha understands Puria in the sense of Purim, in the sense that Chai Vinish Libsume Bipuria Ad Layade Benor Haman Labarach Mordechai, the obligation to drink on Purim, such as it is. So if somebody asks you if you drank on Purim, you're not obligated to be forthcoming. But that's the less common interpretation, but probably it means the more literal sense. And what that does is that seems to give us three different types of situations. The first one being you're trying to protect people from imposition, and the second, you're trying to be modest, and the third category, modest in the other sense, it's tznius, so privacy. So these three areas perhaps are ways in which one can stretch the truth, and that's acceptable. You're not going to be considered dishonest. So the Rishonim ask, well, what about that other Gemara about Shalom? How come we don't see here listed that one can deviate from the truth for the sake of peace? So some of the Rishonim say that that's because that's an obligation. These are just discretionary examples, and those are different from an obligation where you don't have to be told, you don't need the Gemara to tell you that if you do what you have to do, it's not going to hurt your reputation. But others understand, like Tosa says over there, that it's not that it's missing from the list, this is the list. That these are all examples of Shalom, things that you may want to dissemble about to some extent because you're trying to avoid a fight. Reb Chaim Brisker apparently had that practice in terms of Masechta, which we thought was about modesty, but apparently Reb Aaron Soloveitchik mentioned that his grandfather Reb Chaim, when he didn't want to fight with somebody, so he would say, I can't argue with you, I didn't learn that Masechta. It was a way of avoiding conflict. So maybe they're all examples of Shalom, and these are just subcategories. That's possible too. But either way you look at it, so these, like Yeruchim Fishel Perlau and others, they argued that if there was an absolute Torah prohibition on any kind of a false statement, so then how could we have these permissions? How could these categories be licensed? So it must be that there isn't really an absolute Torah prohibition in these cases. And therefore, there's room to allow it when there is a need, such as Shalom or Mitzvah or Modesty or the like. Maybe there's some other categories, a lot written about where we go, how far these categories go, but it could be that that's more easily understood if we assume there isn't a Torah prohibition on that kind of falsehood to begin with. In general, there is a whole question how to understand, if you want to zero in for a second, so we spoke about it a little bit recently, about this idea of Shalom, to be Mishanev Nehashalom. So already the Sfarim talk about two different ways to understand how that could be, in light of the general assumption that lying is prohibited. So one is to say that there is a values clash, and there is a tension between these two ideals, and one overrides the other. And the other understanding is that there isn't really a tension because in those cases there isn't really a prohibition. There isn't an actual isser, and therefore these cases are not really violations of that prohibition. They are situations where that's the proper path and there isn't really a reason not to. So those are two different ways of looking at it, and that's relevant to this whole question. You have those who say that if there's going to be a permission to stretch the truth in these cases, it must be that there is no isser in the first place. But as we noted at the outset, there certainly is a value of honesty. And presumably there's some kind of a mandate. So therefore, it's really either one way or the other, that either there is a values clash and we're suspending the prohibition such as it is in order to allow for these necessities, or it's that they aren't indeed a violation to begin with. So that goes to this basic question of how to understand Midvar Sheker Tirchak and its role in life, and whether it's possible to sustain both, that there are some exceptions, and there is nonetheless a Torah prohibition of some kind. So there are those who maintain that Shalom, first of all, at a minimum, is a midah, is an attribute. A sheker, emes and sheker is an attribute. And it could be that that's the main thrust of this, that the Torah is describing a midah here, rather than a prohibition. And the Chazon Ish, in his Sefer Emunah Bitachon, formulated something along those lines, because he emphasized that there is a tremendous character issue with falsehood, and that one who speaks falsely demeans his character to a tremendous degree, but it doesn't sound like he necessarily is formulating it as an absolute prohibition. But it's possible that that's one way to look at it. It's primarily a midah, or it's also possible that it's a differently formulated concept. So there are those who are articulated, among them Rav Dessler was associated with this position, that MS doesn't refer exclusively to factually true statements, but refers to the holistic MS, that you're bringing about the truth through what you're saying, even if the words per se are not necessarily all factually correct. That MS has a different meaning. There were those who were very opposed to that kind of interpretation. I read about an exchange that happened between Rav Dessler and another British Talmid Chacham, or one who was functioning in England at the time, Reb Leib Gurvitz, the Rashid from Gateshead, who said, MS is MS. MS means, it has to mean at least the factual truth. And to say that MS is anything different from that, he felt was greatly offensive. But it is perhaps a sustainable interpretation to say that we mean that there could be two different frameworks here. So if we say before that Midvar Sheker Terechalek is a prohibition, but it is specifically in a Beis Din context, so maybe that leaves us room to articulate things a little differently. Ruchem Vishal Perlow, when he talks about that, so he notes that we should be clear that in all the high-stakes environments, when there is a real consequence, so there's no question that dishonesty is prohibited in all of those contexts. It's just we have sources for that, each to its own environment. So if we say Midvar Sheker Terchak is about Beis Din proceedings, so that's one source. Regarding testimony itself, so we have a prohibition, Lo Sana Briach Shaker. We have prohibitions in the business context, so if you're going to misrepresent a price, that's a violation of ona, or a value. If you're going to deceive someone in a sense of getting some kind of social capital, so or some other kind of non-monetary value, so that's Gnevas Das, which could be derived from Lo Signovu. So we have a whole host of psukim that essentially between them cover dishonesty in all of its consequential instances. It's just a question of whether Midvar Sheker Terchak itself is this broad, all-encompassing idea. So it is possible, perhaps, to sustain an interpretation that we could say that MS is really a different kind of mitzvah. It is a mitzvah and a midah at the same time, but even as a mitzvah, it is one that is more result-oriented than process-oriented, and we could call it more of a consequentialist kind of MS, that we are obligated to bring about the correct result, even if that's different from the content of the actual words. And if it's true that Midvar Sheker Terchak does apply as a prohibition in the context of Beis Din, so perhaps we could understand that they work side by side, that overall we're supposed to bring about truth in a consequentialist kind of way. We're supposed to bring about good results. But in a Beis Din, we can't function that way. That is the formal clearinghouse of interpersonal relationships, and this is the authority. So in a formal setting, so then we can't function in a consequentialist way. We have to function there in a formalist way. So it's not up to us to decide how we'll bring about the best result when we're dealing with our basic day-to-day life. So in general, it seems that we're more comfortable with consequentialist behavior when things are a matter of conscience. You can decide for yourself how you are being true to your morals and your conscience and bringing about the best result. But when the stakes are higher, or when we're dealing with formal settings, so then we need to have a formalist system. And it could be that Beis Din is that formalist system, and there truth has to be the literal factual truth. And it's not our job as individuals to try to articulate things in a way that we are bringing about what we think is the true result. We have to let the court decide that and speak honestly and speak truthfully in the factual sense. And we find a few other examples of this, just the idea that the courtroom environment is more about the formal process than other areas of life. So another mitzvah that you have, just other things that are actually all in this week's parsha, but for example, in Parsha Mishpatim, so we also read about the prohibition of shochad, when you're not allowed to take bribes, the judge is not allowed to be bribed at all, and it's clear that that's across the board, not just to bribe a judge to get a bad result, to get a false result, but even to get the true result, that if you could ascertain that you're looking to get the judge to say the correct ruling, but he's not going to do it otherwise, so there's still a prohibition to bribe him in order to bring that about. And that reflects that same idea, that particularly in a Beis Din setting, we don't have the right to be consequentialist about things and say, well, I'm doing things where the ends justify the means. We have to focus specifically on the means, especially in that environment. So there's a prohibition of shochad across the board. It's also interesting to give perhaps another more unusual example. So we also read in this week's parsha about the notion of acharav mahatos, that there is a policy of following the majority in decisions, including in judicial decisions. So a court, a rabbinic court, is supposed to make its decisions based on majority vote. And that is presumably a necessary process to follow to the letter. But there's an interesting discussion, there's an Or HaChaim in this week's parsha, that discusses a very unusual kind of din. And I was a few years ago on a panel with a lawyer where this topic came up, and it was an interesting question. That, first of all, there is a two things that came out of that panel. One is that there is this very unusual din, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, the way most understand it. There's a minority opinion that sees it differently. But there is a Gemara that seems to say that even though we follow the majority of judges when they sit together on a panel, and that's true even in capital cases, even questions of execution, but if you get a unanimous vote in a capital case, they all agree that this person should be executed, so then we let him off, we let him go, which is a fascinating idea why that should be. And in this panel, it was cited that the late Judge Antonin Scalia was fond of referring to this Talmudic statement and has said that that's just a typical Jewish idea, so unusual and counterintuitive and something that he was appreciated greatly. But whatever the explanation is, topic for a different time, but also a part of that panel, the question came up about jury nullification. Sometimes a lawyer may feel that his interpretation of justice is going to be better served by the jury voting against the facts, and if the facts would have said that the defendant is guilty, but they'll still try to convince the jury that they should vote not guilty anyway. So the discussion came up, but there's a parallel to that in jurisprudence. So I mentioned that there is a machlokas between the Or HaChaim and Rav Yonasan Eibshitz about this halacha, that if the Sanhedrin votes unanimously to convict, so then we let him go. So the Or HaChaim discusses, he thinks that a pasuk in this week's parsha is coming to tell you to address that situation, that maybe you'll think, let's say you're sitting on this Sanhedrin, and you're sure this guy is guilty, so you want to vote guilty. But you know that everyone else is also going to vote guilty. So if you all vote guilty, it's going to be unanimous, he's going to be let go. So you don't want that to happen. So you figure, okay, even though I think he's guilty, I'll switch my vote and I'll say innocent. And then he'll end up being convicted because it will be a majority non-unanimous vote. So the Or HaChaim says not allowed to do that, that that's not your job, that you vote what you actually believe. And it's not your job to try to manipulate the results into what you think is justice. The justice will emerge from the system being followed to the letter. And you say what you actually think and don't look to the bottom line and try to manipulate things to get the result that you think is more just. Or to give perhaps some more down-to-earth kind of example, let's say it's a litigation between two parties. So you have a three-judge panel, and normally you'd follow the majority. So Reuven and Shimon are litigating. Two want to vote for Reuven. He'll win against the one who's going to want to vote for Shimon. But the halacha is that if one judge says, I don't know, so then we don't leave it at that, but we have to add judges and then deliberate again. So let's say the one judge who wants to vote for Shimon, he says, okay, if I vote for Shimon, I'm going to lose. But if I say, I don't know, so then they'll have to add more judges and they'll bring in two other judges and maybe I can win them over and it'll be 3-2 and Shimon will win. So is he allowed to do that? Is he allowed to say, I don't know, when he really does know? in order to try to bring about a better result. So here again, the same question, that it could be that the formalism of the judicial proceeding requires that you just vote what you actually think and don't try to be consequentialist about it and to bring about the best result. And that's presumably what we see here as well. So it could be that you have a general midah of MS and also a mitzvah that is perhaps in some contexts consequentially based and allows you to focus on the result rather than on every part of the process. But that can't be extended to Beis Din. That in a Beis Din context, we have to be more formalist and we have to stick to the actual factual truth, and that is therefore going to be a different system. And there are a lot of ways to approach that. And I saw the Sefer called the Dodi Nasan al Torah, where he noted that, going back to the day-to-day context, that it could be that we see Midvar Sheker Tirchak as more result-based rather than formalist, meaning that we have to communicate in a way that will bring about a broader truth. But that itself is tricky because it's very subjective as to how exactly that happens. And it's also very possible that you could miscalculate because of that and taking it into your own hands. So he understands that that's what terchak means. That terchak comes to tell you that you have to take extra effort to make sure not to come up to a conclusion that's going to be run afoul of this value, especially with its subjectivity that's more challenging. So therefore, terchak comes to tell you you have to be more careful than otherwise in terms of making sure that your assessment is actually correct and that you are going to bring about the best result. So this question of whether it's a midah or whether it's an isser, and if it's an isser, is it an isser ben adam lechavero? So this could have a few ramifications, among them the question of how do you fix it? So if you did violate this isser, so what is involved in fixing it? So as an avera ben adam lechavero, it's going to require apologies and mechila, and also setting it straight to make sure that you undo the damage. If it was more midah based, so it's more personal, and then that doesn't necessarily have the same process. That's more about working on that midah internally. There was one Talmud Chacham who said that somebody who has to do tshuva, who has to rectify his failures in the area of honesty, so he should not avail himself of the heter l'shanus with nehashalom, the idea that you can deviate from the truth in order to keep the peace. He thought that was for the average person who's pretty much in balance in terms of his midah of honesty. So from occasional instance where he needs to compromise the truth in order to keep the peace, he can do it. But somebody who has to work on his midah sa'emes, because he has fallen short on that, so he has to go to the other extreme, and he should never say anything untrue, even for the sake of shalom. And Rav Kook disagreed with that. Rav Kook said that you have to work on your midos improvement program on your own time, that is okay if there wasn't anything else at stake, but there's a mitzvah to keep the shalom, so you don't have the right to pass up that mitzvah, and therefore you would have to still focus on shalom and address your deficiencies in honesty in a different setting. So that is also relevant to this whole question of fixing falsehoods and fixing deficiencies in this area, and the idea of tirchak may create a greater obligation to be careful about this. So we find a number of other interpretations of what tirchak is coming to say. So for example, the Arach HaTzadikim means that it's not just enough to avoid intentionally falsifying things and misrepresenting, but you have to make sure it doesn't happen even inadvertently. So for example, if you're careless in your records, so you're just not careful to make sure that message that you're conveying is true, that would be a violation of tirchak. There's also a discussion in general about when it's a suffik, when you're not clear. So normally there are rules that guide suffik, and there are those who suggest that when it comes to falsehood, so there is a greater need to be stringent in situations of suffik because of this idea of tirchak. Bira Chassin, the Sefer Chassidim, says it's also true in terms of the future. So, for example, let's say you want to tell somebody, oh, this is the case, and if you don't believe me, go ask that guy, and he'll tell you the same thing. He'll agree with me. So that seems like a reasonable thing to do if you were confident, but the Sefer HaChassidim says you shouldn't do that because he's not really in your control, and you may think he's going to say what you expect him to say, but he may not, and then you'll end up misrepresenting. So that, he thought, was a problem because of this Tirchak idea that we have to go to greater extent to avoid dishonesty. And he also writes a Sefer Chassidim that, let's say, if you pry when somebody is possibly looking to keep something private, and you ask them how they're doing when they don't seem to want to be forthcoming about it, because that's clear from the situation, so then bringing about somebody else speaking falsely because they don't really want to be direct with you, so that would also, he thought, be a violation of Mitzvah Sheker Terchak. And it should be clear also that it doesn't matter whether you're writing or speaking, that's a prohibition of Sheker in both instances, that it applies to the spoken word and to the written word. And that is clear from Tosfos and the Yad Ramah, and also from basic logic. But there is a statement of the Maharsha that is probably misunderstood, but it may be what some journalists rely on, the assumption that there is a reduced prohibition, if any, in the context of written word, because the Maharsha discusses the Gemara in Bava Basra, which says that the last words of the Torah, which refer to what happens after Moshe dies, so the Gemara discusses how could it be that Moshe wrote the whole Torah, including the part that takes place after he dies. So one opinion in the Gemara is that everything until that, Moshe, God would dictate, and Moshe would repeat, and then Moshe would write it down. And these last eight psukim, God dictated it, and Moshe wrote it with a tear in his eye, because it was prophesizing his death. But it doesn't say that he repeated it. For the rest of the Torah, it says God said and Moshe repeated. And those parts, apparently Moshe didn't repeat out loud. So the Maharsha says, why didn't he repeat that part out loud? And he writes, because it hadn't happened yet. And therefore, it's mechsi kashikra. It looks like falsehood to say something that hasn't happened yet. So it sounds like he's only worried about speaking this way, but not about writing it. So some read that Maharsha to say, okay, you see that writing is a less serious instance when it comes to falsehood. But that's very hard to believe, and presumably, as others point out, that all he meant, the Maharsha, was not that you can deceive in writing, but that when you're writing, in neither case would this be Sheker. He was talking about the future, and it was predictive, so it was true. It's just had the possibility of looking like Sheker. Moshe was even more careful not even to appear like Sheker. So there's a difference between the written word and the spoken word, because written word is a mode of communication that's going to happen later. So you can write something down now, and people will read it later, and it's going to be true then. But the spoken word, so then, it still would have been true in the larger sense, but it could have looked like Sheker. So that's what Moshe was afraid of. So certainly to assume that there's any leniency when it comes to the written word, very hard to imagine. And in fact, you would say really the opposite, that writing something false is much worse than speaking false because it has much more permanence to it and much more range, especially nowadays with the internet. If you write something on the internet that's false, it's going to last longer and go farther and reach more people. So it seems pretty clear that judging by the impact, which is a logical thing to do, that in that context, falsehood is actually a much more serious prohibition. But doesn't even have to be spoken. The Yehuda Chassid also writes in the Sefer Chassidim that even just creating a false impression without words by nodding or shaking your head in a misleading way is also a violation of Tirchak. And we find other examples of that as well. And the Rabbeinu Yonah is very machmir in general on these issues of Sheker. So he has a list where he says that there are 9 different types of Sheker. Some of them sound very similar to each other, but he says in his Sefer in Shari Tshuva that there are 9 different categories of falsehood, and that only some of them are permitted in those cases where we do find leniency, such as B'nai HaShalom. So his 9 types are, he says, one type is if you cause a financial loss to someone else, let's say by swearing falsely in court, so that's a very severe type of lying. A second is a falsehood that doesn't actually harm someone else, but causes a situation where it's likely to bring about harm, such as bringing somebody into your confidence dishonestly. A third is you don't actually cause somebody else to lose money, but you get in the way of people appropriately profiting. So that's also a harmful deception. A fourth would be if you relate events in a way that is false or inaccurate, but doesn't negatively impact the listener in any way. Fifth is if you make a promise with the intent of reneging. The sixth is if you do promise sincerely, but then don't live up to the commitments later. The seventh is if you try to get someone's good opinion under false pretenses. That's what we call Gnevas Das. And the eighth is similar to that, if you take praise for qualities they don't actually have. And the ninth is similar to the fourth. It's where you do get some advantage of your falsehood, but in a non-monetary, very minor fashion. So he writes to Rabbi Yonah that it's only the fourth where there's no impact negatively on anyone else. It's only there that one is allowed to deviate for the sake of shalom. There's no harm to anyone else, and there's no benefit to you, it's just completely neutral, so that's where we find this license to deviate for the sake of shalom. Not everyone agreed with that. You can see from some poskim that they were even ready to allow Gnevas Das, or some type of beneficial misrepresentation to you, if it had the larger goal of preserving the peace, or some other kind of overriding benefit. But that was itself all discussion, but it's very noteworthy, all these categories that Rabbeinu Yonah has, and just how layered and significant it is. And maybe we'll just close by noting that the Oznayim LaTorah, the Litzke Rav, he writes in interpreting this week's parsha, interpreting Midvar Sheker Tirchak, that the idea is of Tirchak, the reason the Torah phrases it that way is because, really, we can't say an absolute prohibition. Because, as we've noted, there are times when it's necessary to say something that's not totally factual, it's not totally accurate. So to say, never say anything false, that's not an appropriate representation of the Torah's intent. But what we are saying here is that it's unfortunate to ever have to compromise the Midas HaEmes, which is so central to who we are. And therefore, even though there are circumstances where one may be forced to compromise the truth for the sake of peace, if you love truth and peace with equal passion and devotion, you'll do whatever you can to try to avoid being in a situation where you're going to have to compromise either one. And that may take some forethought and some preparation, but that's an expression of the care that we're asked to have for both of these crucial values, and therefore he understands that's what terchak means, that you should avoid being in a situation where you need to deviate from the truth. It may be legitimate to do so under some circumstances, it may be necessary to do so under some circumstances, but ideally you will love truth so much that you will avoid those situations if you can, and try to anticipate them in advance. And he said that's what terchak means. And we'll just close by noting, as we have throughout these months, that we are at a time when we are particularly aware of our state of galus and exile and our lack of full redemption and our constant prayer for rescue from the state of the world as is. And it's noteworthy that the Pasuk in Zechariah states that even though we fast a few times a year in recognition of our galus, but there will come a time when we will celebrate those days as holidays. And the pasuk in Zechariah that predicts that, so it ends with the words, "V'ha'emes v'ha'shalom ahavu," that truth and peace are beloved. And we could understand that to mean, in this spirit, that right now we are in a very imperfect state, to say the least, in the world. And we are praying every day for a redemption and for a resolution of that. And this promise that that will someday come is tied in to this ideal that truth and peace should both be beloved. We should be able to live lives where we don't have to compromise either, and where we can be completely peaceful and completely truthful. And to reach that state takes a lot of passion towards those goals. And that's what the Pasuk is promising us, that the more dedicated we are to these ideals, ideals, and the more devoted we are, that we seek to preserve them both without any compromise of either, completely peaceful and completely truthful. So bringing about a state where that is indeed the case will be a strong step towards that redemption that we so passionately seek. So it's once again the moment to extend the bracha to all of us that we should soon see a peaceful world and a redeemed context, and through our commitment to these values of emes in the fullest and almost all-encompassing sense of the word, and shalom at the same time, we should indeed see that in the very near future. So I will keep my promise of not speaking much longer, and we'll stop there, and I wish you all a peaceful Shabbos, and next week, I'll have to say what night we're doing, because I'm, Ezra Shem, traveling next week, so it'll probably be earlier in the week, but stay tuned, and we'll find the right night.
Okay, thank you.